just a way to make sure that everyone's awake, and talk about how Earth's history shows us that ecological communities change over time. And so what we had in the past isn't what we have currently. And a lot of these big shifts in ecology have happened during major climatic events. In the past, most of those have been caused by geological events, such as major volcanic eruptions, but right now we have a different situation. And what I'm interested in as a physiological ecologist and ecological modeler is what the ecological communities of the future might look like given this rapid period of change. So ocean acidification is an increase in ocean acidity due to an increased atmospheric CO2. And it seems a little odd that a gas in the atmosphere could cause a change in the chemistry of the ocean. But what I'm hoping to do is lead you through the process in which that happens, or by which that happens. And so before we're going to do that, I just want to make sure that everyone's on the same page about what acidity is, what pH is, and what it is that we're actually talking about. So acidity is a measure of hydrogen ions. That's a strict definition. pH is the scale that we use to measure how acidic or how basic something is. So here's the pH scale that we've all seen throughout our schooling. And up at the top, where compounds or solutions are more acidic, there are more hydrogen ions. Down here, where it's more basic, there are less hydrogen ions. So pH is measured on a log scale, like the Richter scale for earthquakes. So on a log scale, instead of counting 1, 2, 3, you count 1, 10, 100. So the difference in the concentration of hydrogen ions as you move up and down this scale is huge compared to what it might be in a typical county. Just like an earthquake of magnitude 8 is a very different beast than an earthquake of magnitude 7. So to kind of exemplify that, a change of 0.1 pH units, which seems very small, is actually a 30% change in the concentration of hydrogen ions. And that's a really important point when we talk about ocean acidification, because people say, oh, well, what's the big deal about a difference of 8.2 to 8.1? Well, that's a 30% change in hydrogen ions. So we know from historical work that looks back at the ocean's chemistry in the past that acidification has already occurred. So this is a map of the world, and on the color axis is what we're looking at here. And the interesting point here is that all of the change in pH from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution to the present is negative. Okay, the more red the color, the bigger the change in pH. And those largest changes typically occur at the highest latitudes. And one of the reasons for that is because cold water can hold more CO2, more gas, than hot water can. And again, we're all familiar with this. You take a soda out of the fridge, and all of a sudden it just starts bubbling out. Well, that's all the gas coming out as the solution warms up. What's coming down here? So now I want to go through some of the scarier parts of ocean acidification, or the chemical equations. But I want to show you how these chemical equations work, showing with data. And all this data was collected, this is a map of Hawaii, which you can't see anymore, but all these data were collected in an ocean station off of Hawaii and then on top of Mauna Loa. So here we have the x-axis is time, and the top graph and the y-axis is carbon dioxide. And what these data traces show is carbon dioxide in two places. The first place is the atmosphere. And so what we can see is that over time, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has increased. The key matter here with carbon dioxide is that it's an acid gas. When you dissolve carbon dioxide in water, it breaks, the water molecule breaks apart the carbon dioxide, and it makes this, which is carbonic acid. Carbonic acid then dissolves into two different forms, a hydrogen ion plus bicarbonate or two hydrogen ions plus carbonate. And I'll get to this a little later on why this is important. But again, I want to show you this with some data. So here again, you have the x-axis time, and let's look here, this y-axis pH. And what we can see is that as CO2 in the atmosphere and the ocean has increased, pH has decreased. And this is from measurement. So we can see that hydrogen ions in the ocean are increasing as CO2 is increased. And then to round this out, we'll get to this ion here, carbonate, because it's really important for a lot of shellfish. So the more hydrogen ions you have running around in the water, the more likely they are to interact with these carbonate ions, and they form bicarbonate. So the more acidic the solution, the less carbonate you have in it. And again, that can be shown from some measurements as well, where we have the carbonate ion concentration decreasing in this water alkaline. So this explains this kind of very complex process with multiple moving parts, all caused by increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and how it interacts with the chemistry. So questions at this point? This is the hard part of the talk. But I think it's really important for people to be fluent with what folks are talking about when they're talking about chemical equations. What is this carbonate ion, and how is it decreasing, and why is it decreasing? And it's neat that you can actually see it with these long-term time series on the wire. Okay, let's go back to some words. So when we think about what might happen in the future if carbon dioxide emissions continue as we expect they will, we'll have a 100 to 150% increase in ocean acidity by 2100. And that's not a pH change, that's the change in the concentration of hydrogen ions. Okay? So we get to this issue that pH is on the log scale. So CO2 is not the only thing that's causing acidification in coastal environments. There are a number of other processes that can change the chemistry of the nearshore marine systems. And a lot of these are depicted here in this image, which unfortunately is a little hard to see. So we know that fresh water is more acidic than marine water, so that changes marine chemistry. We know from acid rains and that whole story that some of the effluents from industrial processes, these NOx gases and SOx gases, those can also be acidic compounds in the marine environment. But then there's all these other things. We have stormwater runoff, crop runoff, erosion from both kind of rural agricultural areas and suburban and urban areas. Well, the main thing that comes into marine systems there, often coming in through the freshwater, is nutrients. Lots of people think, well, nutrients should be a good thing because it's a fertilizer. Well, what happens when you put nutrients in the marine environment in pulses is that it typically causes phytoplankton blooms. Again, people will be like, well, that'll be great. The zooplankton will all come in and eat it, and it'll be a really productive system. Well, that's not how it works. The phytoplankton often bloom so quickly, the zooplankton populations can't graze at all, and the phytoplankton simply die. And that's when the bacteria come in. The bacteria consume all of this extra carbon, and they breathe just like we do, so they turn oxygen into carbon dioxide, creating a low oxygen environment and a high CO2 environment. And again, this is a process that we're all familiar with. So the pH scale to measure acidity was developed in the Carlsberg Brewery, and it was developed by Professor Sorensen to understand the process by which yeast and beer basically create carbon dioxide and create this carbonated beverage. So this is a great entree at the next cocktail party you are. Okay, so we're going to move into biology. So questions about the chemistry before we move on? And Joe's going to talk a lot about the details of main ecosystems.
No,
I'm not. Okay, we'll talk about the same chemistry? More so All right. Well, let's start thinking about the fate of marine communities under ocean acidification. And first, I'll ask you to do a little experiment by yourself, if you want to. Hold your breath. When you hold your breath, most people think that, oh, I want to breathe because I'm running out of oxygen and I'm using it all up. And actually, it's the opposite. The urge to breathe is caused by the buildup, your body sensing the buildup of carbon dioxide in your body's fluids and tissues. And so you're sensing that pH change because of carbon dioxide buildup. And so that desire to breathe is not a loss of oxygen, it's an increase in CO2, and we all know how sensitive we are, because if you haven't started breathing yet, you can have that really strong urge. All right, so physiological systems are very sensitive to pH and to carbon dioxide. Hopefully everyone's breathing. So there's this respiration effect, and highly mobile species like some squid, increased carbon dioxide in the environment can make it hard for them to get oxygen to their very metabolically active tissues. The opposite is the case for things like seagrasses, which are actually fertilized by extra carbon dioxide. Then there are a lot of more complex processes in which ocean acidification and the variety of chemical changes it causes can influence things like the development and the life cycle of some organisms. It can influence growth of calcifiers and things that don't calcify, like this little silver. And it turns out there's some really odd impacts of ocean acidification on the behavior and nervous system of some species that have been studied. And I'll go into that a little more in detail later. One thing when you hear biologists talk about the impacts of ocean acidification is they often talk about larvae and development in young organisms. And the reason why that is because the process of development, you have one chance to do it right. So an organism has one chance to go from an egg into an adult and all of the different changes in morphology and body that causes. So this is actually a larval sand dollar, and this is the adult. They look very, very different. And so when people are studying ocean acidification, they're very curious about how the energetically demanding conditions caused by ocean acidification can change the progression of an organism that looks like that to the adult form. And ocean acidification and the biological impacts, it's a very young science. And so there's a lot that we don't know yet. There are a few things that we know with some pretty strong certainty. But a lot of our understanding of the biological impacts are actually coming to infer knowledge about multiple species impacts, community impacts, from the limited amount of information that we have. And this is a very important thing to keep in mind when we start thinking about ocean acidification and the management and policy context, is that there's a lot of answers that we wish the scientific community had at this point and which it doesn't. One thing that we do know is this carbon chemistry, this ocean carbon chemistry. I showed you this equation before, where CO2 increases in the atmosphere and the seawater causes an increase in acidity and a decrease in carbonate ions. When we think about shells, instead of thinking about the pretty part, if you think about what the molecule is, it's calcium carbonate down here. When you have a shell in water, the shell is constantly in flux between being dissolved and being, a solid mineral. And the more you decrease carbon dioxide, the more likely the calcium carbonate, the shell material, is to dissolve. And that's what people are talking about when they're talking about saturation state of things like aragonite and calcite, which are two forms of calcium carbonate. So when saturation state is really high, the pressure for calcium carbonate to dissolve is low. When saturation state is really low, there's very low carbonate ions and a lot of pressure to dissolve. Does that make sense? Now let's start thinking about
that one again.
Sure. So when you have ocean acidification, more CO2 around, you have more hydrogen ions and less carbonate ions. So now let's think about a shell. These shells are made up of calcium carbonate. When you have a shell in water, there's this boundary between the calcium carbonate crystals that make up the shell and then the calcium and carbonate ions that are in solution in the water. When you decrease the amount of carbonate ions in solution, there's this pressure for the two shell and the solution to come into more of an equilibrium. And so what you get is a higher proclivity of this calcium carbonate shell to dissolve when there are less carbonate ions around. And that's basically the fundamental principle behind what we talk about when we talk about saturation state. Saturation state is a shorthand for that. And the less carbonate ion you have around, the lower your saturation state. So now let's move on to people and organisms. And I'm going to give you a West Coast example because I know a lot of the East Coast experts who have done their research here, like Mark Green, are in the room, so I'll let them talk about their own research. This is some, but he's not going to talk about it. Maybe we can force him. So there's a really interesting thing that happened on the west coast of the U.S. where the oyster industry started failing. They couldn't produce enough larvae in their hatcheries to maintain the industry, and this was a crisis. And it was a crisis that actually caused a lot of funding from the federal government to go to ocean acidification research. What they were able to do is take advantage of the fact that there's variability in the carbon chemistry of this hatchery in Oregon. And they were spawning their oysters at different carbon chemistries. And so here we have data of the year in 2009, and here's a measure of pH, and here's the saturation state I was talking about. So these spawning events, which are these dots here, happen at different pHs and different saturation states. So they said, oh, well, what happened to that spawn when they respond under different conditions? And what they found is that as saturation state decreased, or as pH got lower, production in the hatchery was lower. And what they also saw was that growth in the feeding stage was slower when the oysters respond at a low pH. And so this is out of the laboratory in a hatchery, a direct effect of changes in ocean carbon chemistry on oyster production. Yes, okay. So you need an understanding what that may look like. Here's an oyster at day 1 and day 4 in a high pH environment, and here's what it looks like in a low pH environment, indicative to what some of these levels were down here. And oysters aren't the only ones that respond in this way to ocean acidification. This is some of the work that's come out of Long Island, where you have a decrease in size of hard clams and scallops when they're reared in low pH versus high pH. But this rule isn't hard and fast. Species are variable in their response to carbon chemistry. So some Smithsonian scientists did a study on these two species of oyster, which are in the same genus. And what they found was that the eastern oyster development was harmed by ocean acidification, but its sister species, the Sumina oyster, didn't respond to acidification at all in the way that they were measuring. And that seems to be, it might potentially be the case in lobster as well. So there are two studies that I could find in the literature on Homer's genus, lobster genus. And one was done in the UK on the European lobster, and the other was done up in Canada on the American lobster. And what both studies did was that they took newly hatched larvae, they kept them in a controlled treatment, an acidified treatment, and they watched the process of development. On the American oyster, what they found was that in the acidified treatment, as the organism developed, the carapace was smaller. So smaller larvae in the acidified treatment. What they also found was that the time it took to change from one life stage to the next was longer. So that were this to happen in the wild, the organism would be in the zooplankton for longer. And there's some potential evidence that there might have been a survival decrease in stage 3. But again, this work should probably be replicated because it's the way that they conducted the experiment in terms of the chemistry could have been a little better. But it gives us some evidence of what might happen. In European oyster or lobster, a different situation. They saw no impact on growth. They didn't measure timing of development. But what they did find is that in the acidified treatment, this first post-larval stage that settled out was lighter, and it had less calcium in its carapace. So some potential impacts on lobster, but again, these studies should probably be redone in a little bit more sophisticated way to really get a handle on what might happen to lobsters. And one thing that's really important to recognize is that there are going to be a lot of surprises in terms of how marine organisms and ecosystems respond to acidification. We've seen a couple of these already. For example, harmful algal blooms, which I'm picturing here, seem to bloom more readily and produce more toxin in acidified conditions. So an increase in harmful algal blooms could be a big player in marine ecosystems. I put this little clownfish on the left to represent a lot of work that's come out of Australia, which shows that when young clownfish are raised and another reef fish are raised in acidified conditions, there's this really big change in their behavior. They swim towards their predators. They can't find their typical habitat. And it turns out that living in acidified conditions changes the way a neurotransmitter works in their brain. Okay? Just like taking antidepressants changes your behavior in a whole scale way. And you have a similar behavioral change or a similar type of behavioral change by living just in a sedentary condition. So there are these really big unknowns out there in terms of the science. So what I'm going to do is talk about communities for a couple minutes, and then we can go to questions. So I've talked a lot about individuals, that individuals are individual species, but they're arrayed in communities and ecological systems. And it's really this interaction of how species respond to acidification that's likely going to be most important. So we have a couple of natural experiments that are occurring around the world because of volcanic events. So this is these are two pictures off of the island of Ischia, which is near Pompeii in Italy. And because of the volcanic activity there, they have these champagne sites where CO2 literally bubbles out of the ocean floor. And what you can see in these two sites, which are probably just tens of meters apart, is very different communities. In the low CO2 kind of normal atmosphere water, we have a lot of calcifiers, urchins, these calcifying algae, and a lot of diversity. In a high CO2 site where we have this, you know, bubbling of CO2, you see a lot of life there. But it's a different type of life. A lot less calcifiers, a lot more algae living in that ecosystem. So this gets us into direct effects and indirect effects of acidification. And in the food web context, because species are always interacting. So let's say, imagine we have a direct effect of acidification on something low in the food web. Well, that can actually cause an indirect effect on something we don't expect to respond to the changes in chemistry due to ocean acidification at all. So there's the potential for an impact maybe on a whale, if krill species, if main food goes down. So when you think about the impact of acidification on ecological communities, there's not only the direct effects, but the indirect effects that have to be considered. So for example, species affected by ocean acidification will also be affected by predator-prey interaction. Let's say a species suffers in its reproduction due to ocean acidification. Well, if its main predator also suffers in terms of reproduction, maybe the population won't change at all. Ocean acidification will impact species unaffected by changes in pH via predator-prey interaction. And that's similar to what I was just talking about with the whale. But you can think about that with groundfish and shellfish also. A groundfish population might be affected if its prey are shellfish prey. Which species are affected by ocean acidification will drive the nature of the food web response. So in some modeling that I've done, I've seen dramatically different changes in potential food webs if I create basically a negative ocean acidification effect on copepods versus on krill. So which species are affected by acidification is really going to matter in terms of what the ecosystem looks like. And similarly, ocean acidification impacts on just one or a few species can have big effects on food webs and ecosystem services. So it's not that every species has to be affected by ocean acidification for a community to be affected. Just a few important ones are impacted, the community can change. And this is similar to that keystone species concept. And then it's important to recognize that ocean acidification is not happening in a vacuum. It's happening along with climate change, a lot of deoxygenation of submarine systems, pollution from nutrients and other types of industrial processes. And then again, people are part of the food web in terms of fishing and in terms of the multiple ways in which we interact with marine systems and living marine resources. So I'll end with a very basic summary. We know that the ocean is acidifying rapidly. And you can see why that is happening from these basic chemical equations that I went through. We know that some local species will be sensitive to ocean acidification. But we also know the biological response to ocean acidification is very well among species and can be really complex. It can be complex in ways that we don't quite yet understand. We know that an impact to ocean acidification will ripple through food webs. So not all species in the food web need to be affected by these chemistry changes for the whole food web to be affected. And then we know that other stressors can exacerbate species' response to acidification. So for example, acidification plus climate change might cause very different impacts than just climate change alone or acidification alone. And I've added this one last slide to have some show you some video resources on ocean acidification, and maybe I can leave you with the meeting convener, because there are some great personal stories and some kind of cool demonstrations about the science of acidification. So, that's the last slide I had, and I'd love to answer questions.
Well, I saw some brockweed in one of the slides, or a brown seaweed anyway. Do you have any information on the effects of acidification on brown seaweed?
Brown seaweed in particular, I'm not going to be able to speak to that. I've done a recent analysis of the literature, but keeping everything straight in my head is just going to be challenging. What I do know is that a lot of the algae do respond positively to acidification, but there are some funny interactions with temperature and then with light intensity, and so kind of characterizing the response can be challenging in terms of what might happen in the field. But like many of the marine plants and algae, they can be kind of positively affected.
Well, something I've read said that rockweed secrete an enzyme that keeps periwinkles from eating them, which is why there's always plenty of rockweed and plenty of periwinkles. But with acidification, it may reduce the amount of that enzyme being produced. So there may be that side effect, as you're saying, an indirect effect.
Right.
But that's why I was asking if there's been research on that. It's a very important plant, obviously, for here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I can look through a database and I can get back to you on that. Maybe we can email about it.
Okay.
Because there's you know, it's funny, the number of papers that are published on acidification is like exponentially increasing. It's just going like this. So it's very hard to keep a handle on what is out there in terms of the state of science. Yeah.
You said that the oceans are 30% more acidic now than they were in pre-industrial times. I was wondering what you could say about what the previous levels of pH have been in Earth's history, and how does where we are now compare?
Well, thank you for letting me go through the slide that I chose to skip because I don't know. What this is, I think it's a really cool time series of ocean pH going back about 500 million years. So let me explain the x-axis first because it's kind of complex. Out here on the side, each unit is 10 years, so these are centuries. When we get to this point, each unit is 0.5 million years, 500,000 years, so unit changes 1 million years. Here's 10 million years unit change and 200 million years unit change. So big differences in time as we go across the x-axis. What you can see is that over time, pH has actually been very different. The marine chemistry was quite different. There was differences in the number of ions that were in the ocean. So pH means different things depending on the marine context. But we do know that pH has changed a lot over Earth's history. Let me put this in context here. So here we are right now. We're in this cloud of pHs, and we expect in about 100 years to be down here. And let's think about the rate of change here versus the rate of change here. So this is occurring over maybe 100 years, or we expect it to occur over 100 years. Similar changes in pH occurred over tens of millions of years. And so the rate of change of pH now, and Dwight, catch me if I'm wrong on this, is something like 10 times greater than it has been in the past 50 million years. Is that the statistic?
Yes, right.
Yeah, so orders of magnitude larger than any change that marine species that exist right now have seen in the past. And I'll put this into context for you. So right around here was the dawn of man. The last two times in history where we were at a pH where we are now was the dawn of horses and the dawn of fishes. The last time we were where we expect to be in 100 years was when T-Rex was on the Earth, and then we were lower when velociraptors were around, and here's the dawn of complex life. And so, yes, there will be marine species in the ocean when pH is lower. We know that's the case. But the issue and the reason why a lot of biologists are concerned is this rate of change. Mm-hmm. And we're very uncertain whether species are going to be able to adapt to this change in chemistry. Whether they're able to, they have enough flexibility to deal with it, whether they're going to be able to adapt to it or not. There's some evidence that some species can adapt, but how far they can go is a question. So I want to make sure that we transition to Joe's talk. Are there any last burning questions for Sam?
Just the under video resources, another really good piece was the one by the Seattle Times that came out last year called Perilous Seas.
So it's Craig Welch's Sea Change, and I think if you just Google Sea Change Seattle Times, it's a great, thank you, a great series of articles, videos, paintings, interviews. It's really great.
Well, thank you very much.